Mitchell's idea of dark stars was based on Newtonian physics, in which time was absolute and went on regardless of what happened. Thus, they didn't affect our ability to predict the future in the classical Newtonian picture. But the situation was very different in the general theory of relativity, in which massive bodies curve space-time. In 1916, shortly after the theory was first formulated, Karl Schwarzschild, who died soon after of an illness contracted on the Russian front in the First World War, found a solution of the field equations of general relativity that represented a black hole. The Schwarzschild Black Hole. Schwarzschild's work revealed a stunning implication of general relativity. He showed that if the mass of a star is concentrated in a small enough region, the gravitational field at the surface of the star becomes so strong that even light can no longer escape. This is what we now call a black hole, a region of space-time bounded by a so-called event horizon from which it is impossible for anything, including light, to reach a distant observer. For a long time, most physicists, including Einstein, were skeptical whether such extreme configurations of matter could actually ever occur in the real universe. However, we now understand that when any sufficiently heavy, non-rotating star, however complicated its shape and internal structure, runs out of nuclear fuel, it will necessarily collapse to a perfectly spherical Schwarzschild black hole. What Schwarzschild had found wasn't understood or its importance recognized for many years. Einstein himself never believed in black holes, and his attitude was shared by most of the old guard in general relativity. I remember going to Paris to give a seminar on my discovery that quantum theory means that black holes aren't completely black. My seminar fell rather flat because at that time almost no one in Paris believed in black holes. The French also felt that the name, as they translated it, trou noir, had dubious sexual connotations and should be replaced by astre occulte, or hidden star. However, neither this nor other suggested names caught the public imagination, like the term black hole, which was first introduced by John Archibald Wheeler, the American physicist who inspired much of the modern work in this field. John Wheeler. John Archibald Wheeler was born in 1911 in Jacksonville, Florida. He earned his PhD from Johns Hopkins University in 1933 for his work on the scattering of light by the helium atom. In 1938, he worked with the Danish physicist Niels Bohr to develop the theory of nuclear fission. For a while thereafter, Wheeler, together with his graduate student Richard Feynman, concentrated on the study of electrodynamics. But shortly after America entered World War II, both went on to contribute to the Manhattan Project. In the early 1950s, inspired by Robert Oppenheimer's work in 1939 on the gravitational collapse of a massive star, Wheeler turned his attention to Einstein's theory of general relativity. At that time, most physicists were caught up in the study of nuclear physics, and general relativity was not really regarded as relevant to the physical world. But almost single-handedly, Wheeler transformed the field, both through his research and through his teaching of Princeton's first course on relativity. Much later, in 1969, he coined the term black hole for the collapsed state of matter, which few yet believed was real. Inspired by the work of Werner Israel, he conjectured that black holes have no hair, which meant that the collapsed state of any non-rotating massive star could in fact be described by Schwarzschild's solution. The discovery of quasars in 1963 brought forth an outburst of theoretical work on black holes and observational attempts to detect them. Here's the picture that has emerged. Consider what we believe would be the history of a star with a mass 20 times that of the Sun. Such stars form from clouds of gas, like those in the Orion Nebula. As clouds of gas contract under their own gravity, the gas heats up and eventually becomes hot enough to start the nuclear fusion reaction that converts hydrogen into helium. The heat generated by this process creates a pressure that supports the star against its own gravity and stops it from contracting further. A star will stay in this state for a long time, burning hydrogen and radiating light into space. The gravitational field of the star will affect the paths of light rays coming from it. One can draw a diagram with time plotted upward and distance from the centre of the star plotted horizontally. In this diagram, the surface of the star is represented by two vertical lines, one on either side of the centre. One can choose that time be measured in seconds and distance in light seconds, the distance light travels in a second. When we use these units, the speed of light is 1, that is, the speed of light is 1 light second per second. This means that far from the star and its gravitational field, the path of a light ray on the diagram is a line at a 45-degree angle to the vertical. However, nearer the star, the curvature of space-time produced by the mass of the star will change the paths of the light rays and cause them to be at a smaller angle to the vertical. Massive stars will burn their hydrogen into helium much faster than the Sun does. This means they can run out of hydrogen in as little as a few hundred million years. After that, such stars face a crisis. They can burn their helium into heavier elements such as carbon and oxygen, but these nuclear reactions don't release much energy, so the stars lose heat and the thermal pressure that supports them against gravity. Therefore, they begin to get smaller. If they are more than about twice the mass of the Sun, the pressure will never be sufficient to stop the contraction. They'll collapse to zero size and infinite density to form what is called a singularity. In the diagram of time against distance from the center, as a star shrinks, the paths of light rays from its surface will start out at smaller and smaller angles to the vertical. When the star reaches a certain critical radius, the path will be vertical on the diagram, which means that the light will hover at a constant distance from the center of the star, never getting away. This critical path of light will sweep out a surface called the event horizon, which separates the region of space-time from which light can escape from the region from which it can't. Any light emitted by the star after it passes the event horizon will be bent back inward by the curvature of space-time. The star will have become one of Mitchell's dark stars, or as we say now, a black hole. How can you detect a black hole if no light can get out of it? The answer is that a black hole still exerts the same gravitational pull on neighboring objects as did the body that collapsed. If the Sun were a black hole and had managed to become one without losing any of its mass, the planets would still orbit as they do now. One way of searching for a black hole is therefore to look for matter that is orbiting what seems to be an unseen, compact, massive object. A number of such systems have been observed. Perhaps the most impressive are the giant black holes that occur in the centers of galaxies and quasars. The properties of black holes that have been discussed thus far don't raise any great problems with determinism. Time will come to an end for an astronaut who falls into a black hole and hits the singularity. However, in general relativity, one is free to measure time at different rates in different places. One could, therefore, speed up the astronaut's watch as he or she approached the singularity so that it still registered an infinite interval of time. On the time and distance diagram, the surfaces of constant values of this new time would be all crowded together at the center, below the point where the singularity appeared. But they would agree with the usual measure of time in the nearly flat space-time far away from the black hole. One could use this time in the Schrödinger equation and calculate the wave function at later times if one knew it initially. Thus, one still has determinism. It's worth noting, however, that at late times, part of the wave function is inside the black hole, where it can't be observed by someone outside. Thus, an observer who is sensible enough not to fall into a black hole can't run the Schrödinger equation backward and calculate the wave function at early times. To do that, he or she would need to know the part of the wave function that's inside the black hole. This contains the information about what fell into the hole. This is potentially a very large amount of information because a black hole of a given mass and rate of rotation can be formed from a very large number of different collections of particles. A black hole does not depend on the nature of the body that had collapsed to form it. John Wheeler called this result, "A black hole has no hair." For the French, this just confirmed their suspicions. The difficulty with determinism arose when I discovered that black holes aren't completely black. As we saw in Chapter 2, quantum theory means that fields can't be exactly zero, even in what is called the vacuum. If they were zero, they would have both an exact value, or position at zero, and an exact rate of change or velocity that was also zero. This would be a violation of the uncertainty principle, which says that the position and velocity can't both be well defined.